Blog Talk Radio.
This program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Basically, the 1% of the motorcycle community who operates outside the law.
Their total focus is on nature for the enemy. They have a policy of shoot or kill on sight if they can.
It's bullshit. Law enforcement just tries to paint this picture to the media to just cover up their bullshit, cover up their lies, and I just like to say fuck them.
Well, hello there.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you? I heard you're having a heat wave back.
Oh, yeah. We're in the 20s. I've been under the electric blanket.
8 degrees this morning when I got up.
Where you're at?
Yep.
What was it?
28 degrees.
Oh, you know what? We were so much colder. I've been
in shorts. 8 degrees
up
the ocean, dropped another 5.
Well, yeah, but I'm not that far from the lake, so we still get the lake breeze. I've been in shorts and a t-shirt all day and under the electric blanket. Well, it's real cover.
You're in shorts and a t-shirt, so you got under a blanket? Why didn't you just put on a pair of sweat pants?
Because I had 2 child sits, so I didn't have a lot of time to do a whole lot of anything. So I just figured, okay, I'll stay in this and no big deal, you know.
You deserve that goddamn cold, you. Oh, it was in the 60s and 70 degrees.
Hey, you know what? I got a news flash for you. You know what it is?
Put your ass on some ice, baby.
You know what it is? Go Niners.
Oh, those are fighting words, man. If you were on the East Coast, we would be, it'd be on. It would be on. You better
tell you something. Watching that game, watching Brady, I'll tell you what. Next year, everybody's going to be doing hurry-up offense.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something.
Put them with their pants down.
Hey, I have no problems with my quarterback on my team, dude. Do you know how many years they've been in the playoffs now since Brady's been behind the, you know, in the quarterback position?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, I have no problems with my team. Brady can retire anytime he wants to. I will cry for weeks, but I'll be over it. It's all good.
Yeah, just have a glass of wine and a doobie. You'll be all right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Did you see that photo? I was so damn tired. My kid's like, you look like a stone.
What? What did I miss?
You missed the photo that was posted up on my wall with me and Lil Man. I was so stinking tired. I only had like a couple hours of sleep, you know. So,
I wrote nice pictures. She called me a smartass. Do you believe that?
Yeah.
That's because you know what? We never know when you're being serious and when you're being a smartass.
I know. And
hey,
you know what? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you got the floor, man.
I was just gonna say by looking at it. You know, like, because, you know, my daughter's like, oh, my God, you look so tired. And I'm like, no, I look like I'm stoned. It's a party.
Hey, I want to give a shout out to Mr. Miles. And he knows who he is. He's out there in California there, Phil, with you guys.
Know the man personally.
Yeah, he's in the coffee club.
Yeah, and, you know, because he said that basically I could take your job away from you, sweep you under the seat because I had this accent going on. He said, you could tell you are a New Englander. Because you got one hell of an accent. And I listen to myself and I'm like, accent? I'm like, everybody else talks funny. I don't talk funny. Do you think I talk funny? I don't talk funny.
No. But Sam used to talking to people all over.
Yeah, exactly.
They did the same thing to me when I first came out here.
Oh, yeah, because you were from Chicago. That area.
Hey,
we still
say Dago. We don't say wife beater.
Yeah. Nah, we say wife beater here. It's a wife beater. What did you wear in a wife beater?
I know. That one,
but he looked at me like I just swore at him.
Oh, I'm telling you, the first time somebody asked me if I had a wife beater, I'm like, what the hell is that?
Hey,
and
I
they're
was...
like, you know, it's a tank top. I'm like, no, it's a Dago tee. And they're like, see, as soon as you said that, we could tell where you're from.
Well, I was talking to one of the hens that hang at the gym. Her name is Kelly. And we were talking about Sons of Anarchy, and she just kind of, like, spazzed out, flipped over, eyes got all buggy, and she was like, nobody could do anything in my house when that show's on. And she got into some, you know, detail and stuff. And as soon as I said, you know, I'm like, you know the dude from the Mayans? I'm like, Mr. Emilio? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, well, he calls the show every now and then. I said, you should call in and say hello. And she got all bugged out. She thought I was, I think she thought I was, like, you know, fibbing. I told her, I said, you know, I'm like.
Thought you were in the crack pipe, huh?
Yeah, but I told her, I said, watch for the link. I put it up on my page, you know. I'm like, call in, say hello, or bitch about something, do something, you know. I'm like, open up your mind a little bit. See what happens.
Well, you know what I'll do is I'll send you an email with that link.
Yeah.
You can give her that link and she can listen to it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That works.
And then she would know you're not on crack.
Yeah, well, I told her, I said, you know, I'm like, you can either, like, log into, you know, the Blog Talk Radio. And I said, there's a little chat room there where everybody just kind of sits and chills. Or I said, call by cell phone. And I'm like, you don't have to say anything. I'm like, even if they holler out half your number, you can sit there and just, you know, keep your mouth shut and just listen.
Yeah.
Because she's a boxing fiend. Let me tell you something. That girl can box. And she gets on the floor and she does anywhere between 500 and 800 push-ups. And I'm talking not like 1, 2, 3. I'm talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, she works our asses. Works. It's not even funny. Girl's got it going on.
Good.
Yeah.
Say hello to Eunice.
Eunice!
Hi, Eunice.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good.
How
you feeling?
How are you feeling?
Feeling a lot better.
Awesome.
I really am.
Awesome.
We've got some. You've heard me speak of the attorneys that have been working on this bill, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
They're calling in tonight.
Nice.
So they can explain a lot, and you know, I think you'll really enjoy them. I know I do.
Really?
Yes, I do.
Phil, don't get fresh with Eunice.
Will you let him get fresh with me, for God's sakes, girl?
No, I can't, man. It's a whole respect thing, Eunice. You know, it's like when he talks to you, he should be asking you, do you want a little wine? You want a slice of cheese? Would you like a cracker? You know?
Hey, now, come on, girls. What I need is a doctor.
Oh, no.
Dr. Phil.
Doctor. Where's Phil?
Dr. Phil.
Well,
yeah, so.
According to Eunice, we're going to have Mitchell and Carmen on.
Yes.
Ooh.
Mitchell Garabedian and Carmen Dursel, who are the two big lawyers in Boston that settled that $89 million case against the Catholic Church.
Wow.
And they are also the ones that did this bill for us, you know, on pedophilia. So I figured it would be nice if we had them on and anybody can ask them any questions. A lot of things that I can't answer and they can, you know. And they were very graciously said that they would do that. So I don't know if they're in the room yet.
I haven't seen them yet.
All right. The numbers would be 617.
Mm-hmm.
I have other people that are going to call in and listen too. So,
okay.
Carmen's wife will be there, Roseanne too. This is kind of a big thing, girls. I think this is going to really make
things,
things. Yeah, yeah. I really do. We need to. You know, it's one thing listening to me. But it's another thing listening to other people that have worked on this bill so highly, you know. Right. I know Senator Brownsberger is working very hard to get a special committee together. From what I heard today, Carmen can probably fill us in on this. But it's, you know, I'm happy they said yes, that they would come on and they would answer any questions that they could. This is, to me, this is great, you know. What time is it? Oh, come on, guys, call in. I told them 9:30, Phil.
Okay.
So, but this is going to be great, so don't be afraid. Anybody else in the on the line yet, Bill? Phil?
No, not yet. Just started.
Yeah. What are you laughing for, girls? Get the cheese and crackers out and wine. And we'll
no, I only had like a couple hours of sleep, so I'm like a slap happy brunette coming out of a blonde head.
My God, that's too funny.
Yeah.
And I'm actually eating cheese and crackers. I'm not kidding you, man. I've got some Hoffman's cheese and some Ritz crackers. Ain't nothing like a little cheese and crackers, and you know.
We've got about 50 tubes of Hickory Farms summer sausage you could use with that.
What'd you say? You're eating head cheese and Nora's playing with sausage?
No, I did not. No, I Phil, you really need to go soak your head sometimes. I swear.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I'm sorry I called you at work today, Phil.
Don't worry about it.
He likes that. He can bug him the way he bugs us, you know?
Yeah, you have an interesting life, Phil. Working on the ships and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
He likes
I mean,
to show his big guns.
You cooked up fresh tonight, boy.
Oh, I almost choked on my crackers.
Jesus. Don't do that.
I will try not to.
Didn't you see that picture, Stacey, or no?
I did.
Yeah, and you know what? My comeback was, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Had to bust his balls on it.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know, we take those off, we do all the maintenance, and then we put them back.
Does it take, like, cranes to put them back?
Yeah, my dad used to work for General Dynamics up in Quincy, Mass. He used to build nuclear submarines. He welded type deal, but they had a huge crane. You could see it from the highway. It was blue, big and square, and it said General Dynamics at the top of it. And that was a long time ago because that place is closed now.
Yeah, we got 200-300 tonners and a couple of 250 tonners.
Yeah,
but I mean, like, when you guys work on the guns or something, do you have to have a crane, like, to move it for you guys to work on it and then move it back, or no?
There's, like, four different departments play with it.
Oh, okay.
We do all the welding.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Welding is so awesome.
Yeah, my dad got flash burn a couple of times, you know?
I did the first time, and then after that, no.
You use a potato?
Huh?
Potato?
Yeah, you cut a potato and put it on your eyes.
No, my dad got brought into the emergency room, you know, but I remember it being...
He was one of those old school guys that welded without a helmet.
Yeah, well, you know, he had the old school mask, you know, and my dad would get, if something wasn't coming together fast enough, he'd get frustrated and things would land up flying, so I have, like, perfect vision in my head that maybe something wasn't happening quite the way it was supposed to when the mask went flying. I don't know, but, you know.
I work with guys like that now.
Yeah, one time he came home, both eyes were bandaged up. It was so bad. He was in so much pain, you know, and he said it felt like grains of sand in his eyes, you know.
See, I didn't do that with my eyes. I had the headgear on, you know.
Yeah.
But the first time when I welded, I had shorts on and a tank top. I was during the summer, you know, and nobody sat there, you know, oh, you got to wear pants, you know. So I didn't think nothing of it. And then later I went to go get in the shower. I'm like,
Nora,
why are my legs so hot? Huh?
Nora, when you see welders, what? You see sparks flying. The sparks will hurt you. You need to put the pants on because the sparks are going to go all over the place.
Well, no, I didn't get hit by any sparks. It was just from the light, you know. But, I mean, it was just a light burn, like if I was just out in the sun for a little bit. You know what I mean? But, yeah, I learned real quick.
All right, we have one of the guests. Let me bring him in.
Okay.
Munis, I'll let you do the intros. This one is... Oh, he hung up.
Hello?
No, he hung up.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Which was it?
686.
Yeah. I don't know who that was.
Oh, 617, but 686 was the next three.
Oh, okay. Well, call
probably,
back.
Yeah, he'll call back.
Yeah, it was either Common or his wife or Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
These guys are so... It's so down to earth, guys, really. You're really going to, you know, enjoy listening to them.
Nora talking about Flashburn thought he called the wrong show.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God.
No,
it was
call
about
back.
The big guns.
He'll call back.
Or he got scared when he heard big guns.
No, we got. Let me see who it is. Hello, we got a caller on Skype.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Is this Mitchell or Carmen?
This is Carmen.
How are you doing, Carmen?
Hi.
My name is Philip.
Good.
Eunice
is
on the line with us.
Hi, Carmen. How are you?
Hi. How are you, Eunice?
I'm good. I was just kind of introducing you guys and telling these people how down to earth you are and how much you are committed to this bill and how much you and Mitchell have done for this bill. And of course, you know how upset I was. Common's the one that keeps me calm.
That's a chore.
Well, it's not over, Eunice. And, you know, it's Eunice and people like Eunice who actually keep the bill going, not us.
Carmen, that's not true. You keep me going.
So what exactly is happening at the moment with the bill?
The bill was introduced in the last legislative session. The sessions run through, formal sessions run through the end of July. At that point in time, there were some objections that were raised by one of the two houses, and we tried to get them together in a conference committee during the informal period of the session. The problem is that with an informal session, if anybody raises an objection when they try to bring it on the floor, then that automatically defeats it because they don't have people there in the legislature for a regular session so they can have regular votes. And that's what happened, basically. The people were pretty close to agreement, but they were told that someone was going to object, and so they couldn't do it. So what we're doing is getting the bill refiled. The last couple of days, we've been meeting with legislators who are favorable to the bill. They're going to do everything they can to bring it up for a vote. They're trying to find a way so that we don't have to go through the same conference, legislative committee, rather, that we've been through for the past 10 years, because obviously everybody knows what the bill is about now, and it's not as if they need a committee to say, well, gee, we want to be sure what this is before we send it out to the floor. Everybody knows, so it's now it's time to get down.
Why is it that you can't get an answer on why they didn't pass it?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, too. I'm not understanding why people wouldn't be for this bill in Massachusetts.
Well, sure, I'd be happy to explain. There were three major groups that are opposing this bill. One is the Catholic Conference. That is a group comprised of the four Catholic dioceses in Massachusetts. That's their legislative lobbying arm. The second group is the Mass Hospital Association. And the third group are lobbyists from the insurance industry. And there are 200 legislators, and there are some legislators who care more about what people in those groups think than they do about people who've been sexually abused. Your response to this is, how could anyone be in favor of something that would help people who abuse children? And the response of some of these people is, well, you know, these are things that will hurt business or hurt charitable institutions, and it's terrible that there are some bad people that do these things, but we have to also take care of the organizations. My point of view on all this is that an organization is only as good as the care that they take of children and the responsibility that they show in preventing people from being in a position to abuse children.
Okay.
It's all about the insurance companies, guys, you know, and the non-profitable organizations. And we've fought this for a long time. As I told you before, it was 10 years in the Judiciary Committee because we had this wonderful figurehead that, you know my feelings about him, but it wasn't about us, it was about the organizations and insurance companies, and Carmen can probably clarify this. Mostly everybody that sits on that Judiciary Committee is a lawyer. Am I right or wrong, Carmen?
Yeah, almost every one of them. That's right.
Yeah, they're lawyers.
And most of them favor the legislation.
Yes, you know. But
the way the committee system works in Massachusetts is the chair of the committee is a very powerful person, and the way you get stuff done in a legislature is by bargaining with people. If you support me on this, I'll support you on that kind of thing. And it's very difficult to do something that will alienate the top guy. We got it past him this past legislative session, and it was only because there were concerns about the wording in some of the measures that we got into the situation where an individual could stop it from going through the informal session.
Well, what happened the 25th of July, Carmen, was the House had sent this bill, but also had changed part of the writings that were put in there.
Yep.
And only by sheer luck, through people that I knew, that I was informed about this and got in touch with Carmen, because we were all at the State House at that time.
Yep.
And then what we did was we worked on the Senate right away. And July 31st, some of the senators pulled it out and put it in a conference committee.
Well, that was their way of trying to keep it alive, you know, because
right.
The difficulty you have at the end of a formal legislative session is that there are a great numbers of things that are competing for attention. This is as important as any of those other things, but the senators all have to figure out what can they get done in the time that they have left before midnight on the 31st. And if they can't work out their differences in that time, along with getting the other stuff done that they have to do, like vote on a budget and things of that sort, then they take the next logical step for them, which will keep it alive, which is the conference committee thing that they set up. And they certainly did their best to try to help us get through, but just couldn't get done.
Wow.
But it's not over, and, you know, what we got out of that period of time, it wasn't wasted because people spent time looking at the bill, trying to understand what all the provisions were, how they would affect people, and we got new allies in the fight as a result of that. People who didn't know much about it got educated, people who sort of knew something about it turned into very strong allies that we didn't have before. So it wasn't a waste. We've come further in the past year than we had in the prior 9 years. So.
Now, can the bill go back through again?
Pardon?
Can the bill go back through again at a later time?
The bill will go back again. That's what I've been talking to these legislators about the last couple of days, who is going to file it, what it's going to look like. So, you know, we just because we got stopped at a particular point doesn't mean that we stop in our efforts.
Okay.
We've got, as I say, one of the things we got out of this was a senator who is one of the strongest advocates we've had yet. And this is a guy that, you know, sort of knew something about sexual abuse, but really didn't understand what the issues were. And he's turned into one of the strongest advocates we've had.
That Senator Brownsberger?
Yeah, Senator Brownsberger.
Yeah, nice
now,
guy.
Now, will this affect only your state, or will
yes.
it, if this does go through and pass?
Yeah, it'll. Yes, the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
And for this reason, right now, the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey all have bills with. They're not exactly the same, but they have very similar objectives, and. We're all eastern industrial states, so the things that drive legislators are somewhat similar. Something that gets passed in one of these states is certainly something that will be looked at seriously in other states. And we've talked to advocacy groups in all three of those states, and they are all asking us, you know, tell us if you think it's going to pass, if it passes, because if it does, it will affect strongly what happens in our states. New York State has come within 2 votes of passing this legislation several times in a row. They have an extremely strong effort there. What happened in New York State is 2 legislators changed their party affiliation and voted, and as a result, the Republican Party in New York had sufficient votes to block this. Had that not happened, they would have gotten the matter voted on. They still think they're going to be able to do it, and they think that if Massachusetts votes it, that New York will vote. If New York votes it, I mean, it's like California in terms of the impact that it has on other states around it. It's a big state, and, you know, New York does something, other states pay attention. So.
It's like over here, I'm in California, and up in Washington State, they passed a motorcycle-only checkpoint bill that it couldn't be done anymore, to where they can't just pull you over because you ride a motorcycle. Within a year, California passed the same law.
Yeah.
Which took effect the first of this year.
Well, you know, all it takes some time for a good idea to be picked up in other places is the understanding that someone else thinks it's a good idea.
Right.
And, you know, you understand that California has already had the kind of bill we're talking about in the past.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, I know that in California there are continuing efforts to do something more because the original period of time that they had didn't give everybody an opportunity. And that's what we want to do. You know, we're trying to do 2 different things. We're trying to eliminate barriers that we have now so that future victims of sexual abuse won't have those barriers. But also at the same time, we're either through a window or other devices, we're trying to come up with a way in which people who've been bypassed in other years will have another opportunity to get justice.
We have another caller from Massachusetts. Let me see if this is.
No, that's probably my girl Kelly.
Okay, hold on. 508-567. Did you want to talk? Or
yeah.
Did
yeah.
You
hi, Stacey.
How are you, honey?
I'm okay.
We got some special people on the line right now, Kelly. We have a woman, Eunice, who is trying to get a bill passed to make all nonprofit organizations held responsible for anybody who was possibly subjected to molestation, including the Catholic Church, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That list goes on and on. We have an attorney here also who's working on the bill. Now, the thing that I'd like to ask Eunice and the lawyer, me and Kelly both sit here in Massachusetts, and, you know, what could the both of us, let's say, do to help this bill move along?
I think we got Mitchell just called back. Let me see if that's him.
Okay.
Hello, Mitchell. Is that you?
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Hi, Mitchell.
Good. Hi, Mitch.
Hi,
Brady has a question, man, and I know you're coming in on the tail end of what Carmen said, but maybe between the two of you, you can answer her question. Go ahead, Stacy.
Yeah, there's a very simple answer, and that is, first and foremost, contact the legislators for the community where you live, because that's who they respond to the most. And you start out with those legislators and you let them know that you're a constituent, you vote in their district, and this is important to you. And
okay.
you want them to support that legislation. Then the next best thing you can do is to contact the leaders in both houses, the Senate president and the House Speaker, and contact them too, or do it through your legislators if you can get them sufficiently involved in this. Have those legislators take you in to meet the speaker and say, Mr. Speaker, we're interested in this issue because we care about kids and we really want to see this get done. And, you know, we're talking to our friends and neighbors and they all want the same thing and they think this is an important thing. That's how it may sound silly, but a legislator who hears from two or three people and who take the time to really tell them how they feel, they feel as though they've heard from a big segment of their community. They don't get that many contacts from normal average people. Most of their contacts come from paid lobbyists who are there all the time. So when they hear from real people, it means a lot to them. Particularly if those people are clear about what the goal is and how important it is to them.
And just to complement what Carmen was saying, just don't contact them. Call them, tell them you want to sit down with them. Take your family there. Sit down with these legislators. Explain to them how important this is and how much it means to you. You want to take it a step further than just calling them or writing them a letter. And if you end up with a legislative aide, say, please, I'd like to speak to the senator or the representative. Don't end up with the legislative aide who's going to relay the message, because then you really haven't translated how important this is to you. And
right.
As Carmen was just saying, if they hear from two or three or four people, that's a big number for them, because they're not used to hearing from the people in their districts, because people are so busy right now working and trying to survive that it's unusual. So you really want to sit down with these people, and when you go there, sit down with them, take your families, let your families explain how this is harmed you and what it's caused and how irreparable it's been.
And you really have to push for it. Of course, I'm not a pushy person.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's true. I'm really not.
They call her Shy Eunice at the State House.
and they
run and hide when they hear her name.
And Eunice, can you remind everybody out there listening how long you've been advocating for this bill? And just so people hear it over and over and over again, and it starts to sink through. And, you know, people come together and try to get this thing passed, because, like you always said,
I've really been fighting the church for 32 years, I think it is now. Well, 33, right, Carmen?
Yeah,
33 years?
Yeah.
And due to Carmen handles my son's case, and asked me if I would help, and I said definitely that I would help, but I had to get permission from my son, which he graciously said, "Go get him, Ma." But and it has been a fight. It's been discouraging. Sometimes it's been very hopeful. Sometimes they show no broad respect by bringing out a chair for me to sit in, which Common or Mitchell never got a chair to sit in, right?
And to show you how the length and breadth of this, I have clients who've come to me. Last year, a man came to me who was 87 years old. He said, "I've been carrying this around for 81 years. I need to do something about this." Send them to the legislature. Send them to the senator. Send them to the representative. Because the has narrow vision with this. He hears from the church. He hears from the organizations that don't want this to pass. He hears. But when he sits down with real human beings who've been abused over the course of almost a century, it really impresses that legislature. They really start to understand the problem. And it's very important that you go to see these legislators, you sit down with them, and they get an idea of how broad this is, what the scope is. It's mind-boggling to many of these people when you sit down with an elderly person. I'm sure, Eunice, you know this, you know, and they just look at you and they're like stunned because you're older than the legislator. And they're just getting their hands around this.
Mitchell, tell them how many people out of the country here that you're helping with some of these sexual abuse cases.
Oh, I have 24 clients in Haiti who were sexually abused. They're all basically children. They were abused, at least 20 of these children abused after the bishops in 2002 instituted their new norms and rules and regulations to prevent child abuse. They were abused at a Haitian camp in Haiti, and the perpetrator worked for the Jesuits in Fordham University in the Order of Malta, and he pled guilty to molesting these kids, and he received a sentence of 19 years and 7 months. I went down to Haiti. I met with these victims. This is worldwide. This isn't limited to the United States. And I'm glad you brought that up. Why it's still going on. They violated their own new norms. They really don't care about children or protecting children. They only care about their wallets. That's all this was about. They had this camp down in Haiti, and they in a wholesale fashion, they allowed children to be sexually molested, left and right. And I now have 23 cases of 24 in federal court in Connecticut.
Oh. Wow. It's as we said before, Phil, this is worldwide. And tell them how many people are listening to the show.
Well, right now you've got the United States, Australia, Canada, Sweden, Germany, Finland, France, the United Kingdom, a couple of guys from Jersey, Thailand, Russia, Indonesia, New Zealand, India, France.
Wow. Well, you're naming every country that has had a significant clergy abuse crisis around the world.
Yeah, South Korea, the Ukraine, Russia.
I represent victims from at least 9 or 10 countries from around the world, and I've been doing that for years. It's just mind-boggling. And South America hasn't even really been exposed yet. But there's a major problem in South America with clergy sexual abuse. It has not been.
We've got 1,442 people listening in Brazil right now. In Denmark, we got over 5,000.
Major problems in South America, and just starting to surface now. And unfortunately, and one reason we need statute limitations is individuals cannot come forward. They don't have the emotional strength to come forward till they get older in life, whether that be 30 years old, 50 years old, or 80 years old. And by the time they get that strength together, in many states and countries, the statute of limitations have expired civilly or criminally. And it's too late. But the mind has coping mechanisms. The mind allows a person to just cope with it and talk about it only when they're ready, and that can take decades, and it usually does take decades. Most of my clients come in and they're over 30 years old, most of them. They're not ready when they're 25 or 20, and if they do come in at an earlier stage, they may not call me again for 5 or 6 years.
Right.
That's my experience, because they can't handle it. They're just not ready to handle it. And I've lost a few clients along the way because of suicide.
And a lot of parents can't handle it, you know. And that's a sad part, too, you know, when our children come to us and say, this happened to me. A lot of parents, especially in the Catholic Church, will say, listen, don't you ever talk about that priest like that again, you know. And we're supposed to believe our children. You know, what 7 or 8, 9-year-old boy or girl comes to you and say, Mom, this priest did this to me, you know. I guess I was more knowledgeable than other parents. And in the 80s when this happened, nobody knew what pedophilia was.
Right.
They didn't know until the latter part of the 80s. I think it was, what, 88, 89?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, I was born in 69, and it, my God, you didn't talk about sex. You didn't talk about none of that, you know. And you're right, Eunice, because people started becoming more aware of the do's and the don'ts and how exactly to raise their children a little bit better during the time frame you're talking about. And now, you know, you basically raise your child knowing from day one that, you know, a person isn't supposed to do certain things. But you're absolutely right. And, I mean, call it ignorance or call it just a sign of the times, you know, eventually it all came out like it has now, you know.
You know what I've had some of them do, Mitchell and Carmen, is on the show I would say to them, you know, put your zip code in and see how many pedophiles you got living around you.
Let me tell you how these things are interconnected. You mentioned you've got listeners down in Brazil. I had a client who was sexually abused along with two of his friends in a Boston neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and by a priest. And this priest was a missionary, and he got sent down to Brazil. And when I got this priest's records with regard to my client's case, doesn't it show in his records that he's told his order that he was sexually abusing boys down in Brazil, and he got moved from place to place in Brazil because there were complaints about what he was doing, and finally they ended up sending him back to the United States because he was doing it so much. Here's a guy who's going around the world doing this, and Mitch and I both know stories of priests who have been caught doing this stuff in the United States, and they then get sent someplace. Sometimes it's to a different parish in the same diocese, but sometimes it's to foreign missions or other places where people are not as alert to this kind of thing, and therefore the victims are a little easier for them to come by. So, you know, this is a worldwide problem. And this is something that, unfortunately, we have to attack in each jurisdiction separately. But, you know, we can all help each other by supporting each other's efforts to get these things done.
Well, you know, the way things are going, if somebody that was abused took a gun and killed a priest, they'd be more worried about the gun than the priest, what the priest did to the kid that shot him.
That's right.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is how few people who have been abused have actually been violent towards their perpetrators. It's incredible. I only know of one individual, there perhaps are more, but I only know of one individual who shot a priest down in Maryland, was prosecuted for it, and the jury ended up acquitting him. But I don't recommend violence to deal with this stuff. I don't think many people who are abused end up being violent. Many of them have rage, and they take it out in a lot of different ways, but it's rare, so rare, that they will actually go take it out on the perpetrator. Other people suffer the rage that victims have rather than the perpetrators. It's just the nature of the thing.
Yeah. Many people self-mutilate, slice themselves, cut themselves, put cigarette butts out on their arms, bang their heads against the wall, take showers till they bleed, wash their hands till they bleed, take four-hour showers. What they're doing is they're internalizing it. Because what you have with clergy sexual abuse also is the element of religion. I didn't realize this till I started handling these cases. I'm not Catholic. But many Catholics are called cradle Catholics. They're taught to put the church before their own family. So when they're blessed by a priest, the religion is so deeply rooted in them that they think they did something wrong. The victim thinks the victim did something wrong, and the victim is basically in love with the perpetrating priest and so on so many levels that the victim for the rest of his life or her life thinks that they did something wrong, and they're punishing themselves. And they really need intensive therapy over the course of years to straighten their minds out. And that's one reason why they can't come forward when they're 20 or 30 years old, because they think they're going to burn in hell if they come forward, because the priest told them that. Or the priest told them their parents are going to be divorced if they ever come forward. That's going to be the punishment. Their parents will be divorced. I've had clients come to me 40 years old and said, you know, the priest told me if I ever told anyone, my parents would be divorced. I told somebody when I was like 20 years old, my parents got divorced. I thought the priest was just being accurate. I thought I was being punished by God.
They just know how to manipulate it. I mean, look at our case here. I had three priests that raped me in words, and two bishops, you know. And you still, even though I've dealt with this many times, you cannot pick them out. You cannot pick them out, you know. I get enraged because they think that they can, they think they can overdo me, but they can't. I won't allow them to. Right now I call our Bishop Bob. You know, I mean, he's a man. He's got to pull his pants up the same way I pull mine up. I just will never give up on this. If I'm 100 years old, then they have to bring me in on a wheelchair. But we wouldn't have what we got right now if we didn't have Mitchell and we didn't have Carmen that fought so hard to take care of this and to bring this bill forth. And I'm not making strokes. This is the truth. You know, you don't find too many lawyers that fight as hard as these two men have fought. And I'm sure there's other lawyers that fight too, but they're right out here in the middle of it. You know, I mean, they take their time. They take their money. They're compassionate. And you just don't find that in this world anymore. I think that's and they give me the strength to fight. I mean, I'm the first one that wanted to go to the media and tear everybody's head off, and Carmen says, "Now, Eunice, let's wait until the 31st.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said it very calmly to me. And I was sick to my stomach. I was totally so upset because we worked so hard to do this and to get it passed and to protect our children. You know, to protect the grandchildren. And here we got these dingbats in there. I call them the old boys, that money means more to them and status means more to them.
I don't understand that. How can you put money and status before the well-being of a child? Because, you know, once a child encounters something so traumatic like that, like which was said earlier, they carry it for their whole life. It impacts their whole life. Why would you want, you know, a child to have so many problems when there's something that can be possibly done?
These are people that have no morals. Nothing bothers them.
They're worried.
Don't you understand that? You know, their God is money. And it's true. Their God is money. And they can go to bed and close their eyes at nighttime.
And that's the sad part about it. But if it ever happened to a member of their families, and I've said this before, no matter if it's cancer or if it's any kind of other thing, if it hits you, the family, then you'll fight for it. People, see, this is a dirty little secret, but it's not a dirty little secret anymore. And people, a lot of people can't deal with that.
I just wonder how many people, like one of the attorneys said that he had an 87-year-old man come to him. I'm wondering how many people actually passed away in older age and never got the opportunity to get justice. And
several.
That's sad.
Thousands and millions. Yeah.
Great majority of people who are sexually abused go to their graves never having told anybody what happened to them.
Yeah.
It's the nature of abuse that they feel a level of shame that won't allow them to tell anybody what happened. The people that Mitch and I see are a fraction of the people who are actually abused.
Right.
It's just, you know, just incredible numbers, just incredible, incredible numbers. You know, there's
it's almost mind-blowing.
Legislation that really was touched upon earlier, and that is, how do you stop these pedophiles? They need to be incarcerated. They need to be taken out of society because they don't stop. I've had, for instance, I have Father John J. Gagan here, well-known pedophile. I've had 146 cases against him, okay? 146, and I'm one person. When he was in the retirement home, they were telling me, don't worry, he's in the retirement home. But I have evidence that he was still molesting children when he was in the retirement home. We're talking about people in their late 60s and in their 70s still molesting children. They don't stop. They have to be incarcerated.
What is the limitation in regards to rape?
Well, it's different at different times, and every state has different laws. And that, of course, is part of the problem. I mean, there are states that have no criminal statute of limitations for rape. Massachusetts had for a while had a 6-year statute. Then they increased it. Then they got it up to 15 years. Then they got it up to you had till age 31. And then in 2006, we were working at that time on the criminal statute as well as the civil. The statute at that time was increased to age 43. Actually, it was eliminated entirely, but only if you had corroborating evidence. If not, you had till age 43 to come forward and prosecute the person.
Okay.
That's a lot better.
Each time they change the law, it only counts from that point forward. So,
okay.
2006, when they changed that, it only applies to cases that occur after 2006, unless the previous statute had not yet run out, then you can add the time on. But for the most part, every time we make a change in the criminal statute, it can only look forward. The civil statute of limitations, on the other hand, it's constitutionally permitted to make it retroactive. There was a California case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. California tried to make the criminal statute retroactive, and the U.S. Supreme Court said no. They said you can do it with civil but not with criminal. So the civil statute is the tool we have, in many cases the only tool we have, to go after somebody who can't be prosecuted anymore criminally, but we can still get his name into the public record by bringing a civil suit.
Okay.
You have to look at the law.
I was just curious in regards to some of the cases, you know, that you both work on amongst other attorneys, you know, nationwide here, that when they handle these cases, it's very hard. If you're dealing from a childhood rape, molestation, and they're now 50 years old, and they're now coming forward for the first time, how do you legally, you know, approach these cases? Unless if, like you said, you go through, you know, the civil, if you can't go through the criminal.
I don't think they realize when you
just correct me, Carmen and Mitchell. When you file a claim, you just don't file a claim. You have to go before a board at the diocese. And
okay.
then they have you do a deposition, you know. And I'll tell you, the worst thing that I had to go through was a deposition. And they brought things into this deposition that had nothing to do with the case whatsoever. We had a lawyer who was a woman that looked like a priest. And, of course, she didn't like me, and I didn't like her, right, Carmen?
I think the feeling was mutual.
And she very nicely said that she wouldn't shake my hand because she had a cold. And she very nicely said, I'm the one that dragged you here. Well, I almost went across the table. And I told a very lady, like, nobody but nobody drags me anywhere. And, of course, you're not supposed to ask them questions. But I think I broke that rule probably 110 times through the deposition. But it's not an easy process. I had to do it. My son had to do it.
You're talking about a review board hearing, correct?
She's talking about depositions, Mitch.
Depositions.
Every civil trial.
You don't have to go to the church when you file a civil claim. I just want to clarify that.
No, what she's referring to is the church, the attorneys hired by the church brought her in for depositions and forced her to be questioned under oath about almost every aspect of her life.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
You know,
Hold on one second.
Was about criminal actions and the various laws, and Carmen said you have to look at each state's law. You have to look at each state's and each country's law very closely. For example, in Massachusetts, if a person selects someone and they leave the state, if they leave the state of Massachusetts, every day they're gone, the statute is extended for every day they're gone. Now, I've had 11 claims against a Salesian called Richard McCormick. He used to be the head of the Salesians in the 80s. He was the head of the Salesians. He was a provincial for 6 years. And over the years, I've had 11 cases against him that I've been successful with. And a man came to me, and he said, I was abused by Richard McCormick. This was about a year and a half ago. Now, he was abused by Richard McCormick in Massachusetts, and the case is 20 years old or so. But Richard McCormick left the state of Massachusetts after he molested this person as a child in Massachusetts. So Richard McCormick last year was indicted criminally for molesting this person about 20 years ago. We finally, the criminal laws finally worked in the victim's favor because of the uniqueness of the facts. Richard McCormick molested him in Massachusetts, and he left the state of Massachusetts. Therefore, the statute of limitations stopped running. And this victim wanted to proceed criminally, and he testified at a grand jury, and Richard McCormick was indicted for raping him. So now there's a criminal case pending where this former provincial, who was the head of 15,000 Salesians as the provincial, may end up in jail for molesting this kid.
Wow. Well, they should. They should.
We got
a
caller from Boston. Hello, 978. Did you have a question or a comment?
No, I'm just listening. I can't get in through the site. It's Pete from Boston.
Okay,
hello,
Pete.
Hi, Pete.
Hi there, Nora. I tried 5 times to get on your site. I couldn't get in the chat, nothing. I was just listening.
Okay.
I mean, this talk here could go on for hours, what you guys are talking about, but, you know, people should have opened their eyes when they elected the Pope and they found out later that he was a Nazi. You know, I'm a Catholic, but I was there when Father Gagin was killed in Shirley Prison in Massachusetts, and, you know, I hate to say it, but that mother effer deserved it. And, you know, the priests get away with everything. Like somebody mentioned earlier, what happens to people when they get older and they don't want to come forward that were molested by priests when they were younger? That's a good question, you know. Someone gets older and they're like, geez, you know, they see the priest and he's 80 years old now. And like, that guy molested me when I was, you know, 10. Now the person's afraid or they don't want to do anything about it. You know, I don't know. Good topic, but something that... man, you could go on for hours with this type of.
You need people that, and I said it before. You're saying it. You need people, no matter if it's happening their family or not, to protect your children. You need people to get out there and say, okay, we've had enough of this. When you have a boy that was molested at 7 and he comes forth at 40, because we've tried it. We've taken pictures of them when they were that young, you know, and put it up in front of their face. People cannot relate to that. Or they don't want to relate to that. You know, it's a hard process. And parents, we had in Boston a father that was molested, and then his son was molested. But the father didn't really believe the son until later on because he was afraid to admit that he was molested. You remember that, Carmen? I can't think of his name.
Yep.
And it's because they're afraid to get up. They're afraid they're going to be stricken down by God. But you want to know something? God did not want this for his children.
Well, you know another thing, Eunice, that I think people are afraid of? A lot of the local, I'm going to terminize this as the local pedophiles, okay, the average Joes that walk the street, when a person's brave enough to come forward and they get it in the court system, I mean, I know several people right now that the people were prosecuted and they got 3 to 5 years. You know, you go through a lot of extreme to express a lot of emotion and to stand up for your own rights, and then you kind of get kicked on the, you know, this person's not being locked away for a substantial amount of time. And,
see,
you know,
Stacey, you still have to fight.
I agree with you 100%, but I'm just giving you an overall, you know, perspective of what I've heard people say. You know, they're like, pedophiles do not get a good amount of time. They're not in jail long enough. They come out and they reoffend all over again, and then the cycle stops all over again.
That's why we have to change the laws.
Right.
That's why we have to.
Punishment. You know, I mean, I just don't understand how they can actually put into play, you know, not a long-term sentence in a jail system or what have you for permanently scarring a child for the rest of their life. They're never going to get over it.
But unfortunately, putting them in prison isn't going to take away that person's scars either. Yes, I understand where you're coming from. Yes, they need to be jailed.
Right,
they need to be jailed, but it's never going
to
take that scar away from that person.
Nothing is going to happen if you do not change the laws.
Right,
things have to be modified.
We got a caller from Colorado.
You talking about me?
Yeah.
Hi, Ryan.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
Hi, Brian.
I got to say, hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good. I have got to say, Carmen, every question that I have been writing down since the start of this, I've been sitting here unmuted the whole time you've been talking, but every time I have a question, you answer it. So, extremely informative. The only thing I keep coming up with, trying to figure out how this can go through is, because Massachusetts is more industrial and you said you're kind of having an issue there with getting this to go, what about going to another state that's adjoining and trying to get it to pass there so that there's a precedent? Is that something that's a possibility in a situation like this, or do you pretty much need to just keep hammering down on Massachusetts?
Well, yes and no. The state of Maine has passed legislation to eliminate the statute of limitations civilly and criminally for sexual abuse.
Okay.
They did it prospectively only, which means it doesn't apply to the older cases. So, you know, this is the thing. There are different compromises that people make to get something done. And in Maine, in order to get it taken care of in the future, they apparently compromised on not doing anything for people in the past. You know, and that it's nice they did that. I'd like to see that done in Massachusetts, but I don't want to give up on all those people that haven't been able to get within the statute so far and just leave them behind. So,
right.
You know, different states have done different things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have worked really well. Some of them haven't worked so well. And you've got legislators who have a lot of different ideas about how to do it, and you've got to get them all to be able to agree on one thing that they will vote for.
Right, because what happens on the East Coast happens on the West Coast and vice versa, just like you made the comparison
right.
Yeah.
California.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not going to be done unless we get the people in our own state to do it. You know, what can happen is as more states do this, other states start to say, well, you know, the people in so-and-so state did it and the sky didn't fall. You have to understand that when we try to get this stuff passed in Massachusetts, there are lobbyists who go to the legislature and say, if you pass this law, the Archdiocese of Boston is going to have to file bankruptcy.
That's bullshit.
Well, of course it's bullshit for a lot of reasons. But the point is there are people who believe that or who care about it and who care about that more than what happens to what they think of as a few individuals. So it's very helpful if at some point you can say, hey, you know, they did this in Delaware. Delaware had a two-year window, and you know, we can point to what happened in Delaware. We know approximately how many people came forward and all that. And of course, what they say is, well, Delaware is the smallest state, I guess the second smallest state in the United States, so Delaware doesn't mean very much. You know, I mean, you know, population-wise. But
right.
In Massachusetts, there'll be a whole lot more people, and they would bankrupt somebody. So, you know, as you can get this happening in bigger places, in bigger states, it becomes more, I mean, Maine, I'm not sure what the population is, but it's probably about a fifth of the size of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But if a Massachusetts can do it with 6 million people and the sky doesn't fall, then you can say, hey, it's not going to fall in New York or New Jersey or
right.
Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, I
have a nationwide impact that way.
And I have access to a daily blog, and I just put it up in the chat room. But the page views today was 83,084. And the page views for the last month of December was 1,590,428 people looked at this blog. So if you guys got anything you want to do, Eunice will give you my email address and send me whatever you want, and I'll post it for you every couple of days or daily, whatever you send me.
That's great. We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the insurance company, Common. First of all, every diocese has an insurance policy.
Yeah.
So when they say they have to close the churches because they have to pay these out, the reason they're closing the churches out because they're so old they can't afford to redo them. Plus, they don't have the priest to go in there anymore.
Plus, they're playing shell games with you, too. In Massachusetts,
right.
The Archdiocese of Boston sued Kemper Insurance because they weren't covering them. They settled for $28 million. Now, I had a case during that time period, for instance, and the Archdiocese, I was getting ready for trial, the Archdiocese kept on telling me they didn't have any insurance. And I looked at all the paperwork I accumulated through depositions through years and whatever, and I said, well, you had Kemper Insurance here. What are you talking about? They said, we don't have any insurance. What they were trying to get me to believe is there was no longer any insurance. And I said to them, you just received $28 million in settlement from Kemper Insurance, and you're telling me that you don't have insurance. That's just a play on words. You can't agree with an insurance company not to insure injured people after you receive $28 million. That would be against public policy.
Mm-hmm.
So on the eve of trial, I settled my client's claim case with $475,000. They gave it to me. But they were lying to me. They were trying to get – they were saying of insurance when the truth was they settled with their insurance company. They received $28 million, put it in the bank, but they were trying to get me to believe that they didn't have any insurance money at all when, in fact, they received $28 million. So they were just playing games. They're playing shell games. So you have to be very careful with that, just to play on words.
Now, Mitchell, I got a question for you regarding the money situation. With these individuals that have had this type of abuse in their past, how many of them are just looking for closure, that don't really care about the money, that just want to make sure that doesn't happen to somebody else?
Money's only about, it's a symbol. It's validation that the victim did nothing wrong. I've given hundreds of thousands of dollars to individuals who've called me, I don't know, 2-3 years later and said, remember all that money you gave me? I said, yeah. He said, well, we gave it all to charity. And these are people who couldn't afford to really give it to charity, but they considered it blood money. They didn't want
that. Right. Well, yeah, it's almost like a payoff for the abuse they went through.
Well,
it's validation.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, though. And see, people don't understand that. The money is nothing. The money is nothing. These people took these children and played on their fears and just tangled them so far up. I would love to tell you what I would really love to do to some of them.
I can imagine. Absolutely.
Hold on, Eunice. We got a couple of callers from Florida. Let's see if they have a question or they want to make a comment. 561, did you just want to listen or?
I'm just listening to Eunice.
Okay.
Thank you, Sandy.
386, did you have a comment or a question or did you just want to listen? Okay. He's going to listen. Go ahead. Sorry.
But, the money is nothing, really. I know what I had to do with my son, and I had to be very strong with him, and I had to tell him every single day that it was not his fault. It was the priest's fault. I mean, I had to hold him and kiss him and love him and let him know that I was there for them. In the 80s, that was never done. That really was never done. And only because I was sexually abused, I knew kind of how he felt. I wasn't a boy, so it's got to be more devastating for a boy than it is for a woman being raped by a man and a boy being raped by a man.
Right.
The other thing that I think is terrible is that you can walk into a police station, but you don't see any priest pictures up there. You don't see their pictures there. I did healing masses with our bishop.
You might
up
see
here.
Mine.
Pardon?
You might see my picture there.
No, sir.
Post office. I get confused on the point of, to try to turn things in a different direction as far as, for instance, the church's point of view or the Boy Scouts, whoever these different people are that have actually, there's proof against them abusing these kids. By stepping up and being accountable for what has happened and saying that, we don't have the money to do it, or we'll put all this money toward whatever charity you want or the, the orphan houses, whatever it is, by putting that accountability out there, admitting that they had some sort of a fault and setting something up where they try to keep it from happening, wouldn't that in turn restore the faith in those businesses where people might continue to go to church or to help support them in the future?
The Catholic Church will never admit that they are wrong. They will never admit to that. That would be the biggest blow in the world if they got up and said, yes, this happened and we're very sorry and we will do everything in our power to do it. Everybody has a boss. Everybody. And the bishops mm-hmm. have the Pope and the cardinals to listen to.
the Catholic Church or any church or any non-profitable organization is not going to admit up to that.
Right.
That would be their biggest downfall.
Pardon? The abuse is so institutionalized that these entities for centuries, in many cases, have allowed this knowingly to happen. So if you ask them to correct it, it's like they're a kangaroo court. They're not going to correct it. They're too busy making a profit. They don't want to rock the boat, and they have no interest in correcting it. They may tell you they corrected it, and they may give you examples of how they corrected it, but they really didn't correct it. Earlier, I was talking about my clients in Haiti who've been sexually abused after the National Catholic Conference of Bishops instituted their new norm in 2002. The Boy Scouts are the same way. They don't correct it. It hasn't been corrected. They have no.
Right.
They're not going to tell them what to do. That's their attitude. They tried to correct it. Well, how'd you try to correct it? You've been allowing this happen for decades, if not centuries. All of a sudden, you're going to change your ways. It's like when they appoint they appoint investigators to investigate them, to report about incidents of abuse, the number, the kind of abuse, how often it's happened. That's all sugarcoated because they're paying the investigators. They're not truly independent. And it's a kangaroo court.
That's for
sure. You have to understand what the Vatican is really about. Jason Berry has written a book about the finances of the church. And it's just a fascinating recital of how money works in the church and how much money they have. And the other thing you have to realize about it is that the Catholic Church in the United States is run from Rome. However, the church in Rome is insulated from liability because of the fact that they are a nation state. Except for maybe the Queen being the head of the Church of England, all the other major religions are not part of a nation. But interestingly enough, when John Kennedy ran for president, one of the things that they said to him is, if you become president, will you recognize the Vatican as a nation? And he said, absolutely not. It was Ronald Reagan who recognized the Vatican. And there, since that time, the Vatican has enjoyed this a status of immunity in our courts. A lawyer friend of mine in Texas had convinced a federal judge down there to allow him to take the deposition of Cardinal Ratzinger, who was in charge of the church, the organization part of the church that dealt with abuse. And he was just going to take his deposition at the time that the prior pope died and Ratzinger was made pope. So when he went to continue with the case, someone from the State Department showed up in federal court and said, Cardinal Ratzinger is now the pope. He is now the head of the nation of the Vatican and the Vatican State, and he is immune under our federal laws from being brought into a court.
Didn't that happen with Cardinal Law too, Carmen?
Well, Cardinal Law is in the Vatican in Vatican City, I guess, but it'd be hard to force him to take his deposition because he resides in Italy now, and I'm sure he's not coming back here.
Well, I deposed Cardinal Law in Boston today, and I put him on the stand in Boston when he was in Boston, so he didn't have that insulation in 2002, 2001.
No, not then, yeah.
But he was warned anyways, from what I heard. He was warned he got out of
They got him out of Dodge.
Yeah, they got him out.
Because, he was pulled out of here because it was thought that they might go after him criminally. And who knows if a deal was struck. I don't know. I don't know what was going on back then. But all of a sudden, he was out of here, and they brought in their cleanup man, Cardinal O'Malley, who cleans up these messes. He did
right.
In Florida, and he did in Rhode Island in Porter's cases. And so they brought him in, and Cardinal Law, for whatever reason, left. And I don't think we had appropriate laws to cut the Cardinal Law back then, but
after that, they've created laws to go after supervisors in a criminal sense for this. He just got pulled out of here. They got him out of Dodge.
Aren't they considered co-conspirators at that point?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would think so anyway.
But again, you know, it's still, can you get them into a court within the statute of limitations?
Yeah, right.
You know, that's why cardinal law didn't, you know, there's a priest named Shanley who left Massachusetts and went to California. And only because he went to California were they able to prosecute him in Massachusetts. Now, Shanley was sent there because cardinal law said that he was a perfectly good priest. There was no reason not to send him there. Could they have prosecuted law because of that? Maybe, but the statute of limitations had run out with respect to law. So Shanley comes back. He gets prosecuted. He goes to jail. One of the few who did. And law goes to Rome.
Well, there was a few in the list of dioceses that committed suicide, priest. Do you remember that? That wasn't too long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
So with private citizens, you can go online and you can pull up the list of the sexual offenders. Now, with
there's something called accountability. There's a website called Bishop Accountability. Some wonderful people run it. And what they do is they put on there every priest who has been credibly accused of sexually abusing a kid, whether or not he's gone to jail.
Okay.
And that's one of the few places where you can go and you can get all the public information that there is about whether or not a priest has a past. And if it weren't for that, ability to check that out, there would probably be no way of knowing that some of these priests who were never criminally prosecuted had that kind of a past.
Wow. Right. Well, that was my next question. Since they're in a position of power, if there was another way around it to find that information out or if it was still hard to come by, but that's Bishop Accountability?
Yeah, bishopaccountability.org. You know, you're raising a very good point because many victims feel alone. They feel like they're the only ones who were abused by a priest. They don't feel as though the priest molested anyone. And it's very important that victims realize they're not the only ones, and the pedophiles molest hundreds of children until they're caught. I can't tell you how many people have come to my office and called me and said, I thought I was the only one until I read his name in a newspaper or I saw his name on Bishop Accountability. I've got 129 predators. I've been successful against Catholic predators. I've been successful against on my homepage. They'll go to my homepage. They'll see the priest's name. They'll say, I thought I was the only one. He molested me too. We run into this time and time again over the years. People think they're the only person who's been abused by the predator priest. And they think, no one's going to believe me. Why should I tell anybody? I told my mother when I was 12 years old, she slapped me in the face and said, don't speak about a priest like that. And then it snowballs. There's a snowball effect because by coming forward, the victim empowers himself and empowers other victims and makes the world safer for children. And it's incredible what the snowball effect is and how positive it can be. I'm sure, Eunice, you can speak to that. You see that all the time.
Right. Another question that had been asked of me, and I'm sure Mitchell and Carmen, I'd like you to answer it. How many of these people come forth and have never been sexually abused? I mean, I really wanted to laugh at this question, but only because I know what people have to go through when they accuse a priest of sexually abusing them. It's not a very nice thing. But I don't think there's been too many people, right, Carmen, that's come forth?
Well, you have to understand a couple of things. First of all, it would take an extraordinary person, but let's just talk about men for a second. It would take an extraordinary man who would be able to come forward and say, yes, I was sexually abused by another man. because this is such a cause of shame in these men. They end up in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they end up with gender identity issues, sexuality issues. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't know what to do with it. So, there are a lot of different ways. If someone wanted to run a scam, it's probably the most difficult scam in the world to run. And the second thing is this, and I'm sure Mitch will tell you the same thing. When people come in to see us and they tell us their stories, I think probably we've got a pretty good sense of whether or not whether someone's telling us something that's believable. But we then take and we check their stories. You know, if someone says to me, I was abused at St. Joseph's Parish in Dorchester by Father Murphy, first thing we do is we go find out if Father Murphy was there at that time. There are books that tell you where the priests are in a particular year. And then if he says, you know, I was attending the grammar school there, we get a record from those schools and we find out if he was there at that time. And we do the things, we check the things out to make sure that. Then next thing we talk to him about is, you know, who did you talk about? Who did you tell? And what do they know? And who else says he was abused by that person? So it's really very, very difficult. In Boston in 2003, we had 542 people who had come forward and said that they were sexually abused by different people, by different priests in the Boston Archdiocese. And I asked the mediator who was in charge of those cases, I said, were there any people of the 542 went through an arbitration process to establish what their damages were. I said, was there anybody in that group that you thought was not telling the truth? And he said, no. He said, there were four or five people that I thought their stories were a little shaky. He said, but, you know, he said, they also had suffered horrendous abuse, and they were shaky about everything in their life. They had been drug addicts. They were just barely sober. He said, but no. He said, everything they said made sense. It fit into the time period involved. There were other things that tended to prove it. And more importantly, the Archdiocese had the opportunity to examine all those cases, and they paid for every one of them. So, you know, is it possible that someone could lie? Sure, it's always possible. But they'd have to be damn clever. They'd have to either fabricate or somehow get other corroborating information together. Not easy to do. Not easy to do. And, again, if you're a con man and you want to make money, boy, there's easier ways to do it because the legal hurdles you have to overcome make it anything but a sure thing.
Oh, we had a guy that approached the show, and he wanted to start a thing for. He said he was a vet and all this. He was a vet, but he collected $2.1 million taking his bike across the United States, and never gave a dime to anybody.
Yeah, but
what
listen,
I do too is
there's no shame. There's no shame in being a vet. You know,
right.
That if that guy wasn't telling the truth, he didn't have to worry about the fact that either he would feel personal shame or someone else would think little of him because he was a vet.
He was collecting the money and not turning it in.
Well, I understand, but my point is that the people who are sexually abused, not everyone thinks that you know they feel sorry for them.
Right.
Mitch probably has similar stories. We have women who leave their husbands when they find out that they were sexually abused. They say to them, "I don't think you're a real man anymore." You know,
Go ahead.
It's not easy. It's not easy being a sexual abuse victim, and to pretend to be one is not something that people really rush to do.
Yeah.
I also collect an enormous amount of records. I mean, I collect people's criminal records. I collect
their educational records, I collect their therapeutic records, their medical records, their social security records, and I cross-check everything. And, you know, when you ask a person, and I'm sure Carmen runs into this all the time too, when you ask the priest, their sexual predators was some priests, I've had maybe 50, 100 cases against one priest. I know that one priest doesn't perform oral sex or like oral sex performed on him, for instance, okay? So if a person comes into you and says, oh, I know that priest, he used to do this, that, he used to perform oral sex on me, whatever, a red flag would immediately go off because I know that priest doesn't like to have that, participate in that kind of sex. So there are all kinds of red flags. If I look at someone's educational records, for instance, I had a person who was educated in Western Massachusetts when they were in junior high school, yet they said they were abused in Eastern Massachusetts. So I looked into this, and I spoke to his aunt who came in. She lived in Eastern Massachusetts. She says, oh, yeah, he lived with me during the summer. The victim did. And then I cross-checked the books, and I see that the priest was at the parish where the aunt lived. So there are all kinds of safety mechanisms here and cross checks, and it isn't necessarily the person you want. It's not necessarily the person's committing fraud that you're concerned about. Some people just have emotional problems, and they come in and talk to you, and they're not trying to lie or anything. They just have deep-seated emotional problems, and so. You know, if you can't prove their case, or you don't believe them, I should say, if you don't believe them, then you really have to level with them. They're not trying to make a buck or steal a buck or anything. They just have deep emotional problems, and they don't know why. They've been in therapy their whole lives. So, you know, you have to watch out for that element, too. But it's very rare because society still frowns upon anybody who says they were sexually abused. I mean, we have to get over that as a society, but there's a certain stigma there. And people don't, it's not like a car accident case where a person, there's not going to be a social stigma attached to you, to a person. And, you know, many people don't even want to talk about this, even though they've been sexually abused, because of that social stigma. So it's not the kind of case where a person is going to walk in the office and say, la-di-da, by the way, you know, I was sexually molested. I was molested 25 times. Over the course of 2 years, and you know, I want the world to know about it. There's too much pain there. There's too much pain for the victim. And if you don't pick that up, then you know something's wrong when you're speaking to a person.
Right.
Well, I got to say this, guys. Thank God for Carmen and thank God for Mitchell, because I really haven't heard of too many other lawyers that fight the way they do. You know, and that's true, Carmen, and that's true, Mitchell. You know, you guys have fought very hard.
We couldn't do a thing without you. We couldn't do a thing without you. Okay, so you remember that. You're the hero in all of this. We couldn't do a thing without you. Because of you, other people are coming forward, and you're making the world safer for children. Because of you and your constant fighting for victims' rights, we can do this. Without you, we couldn't do anything.
There's other people out there, Mitchell, that fight just as hard as I do, you know, and it's been a total pleasure, because this isn't about you, and it's not about me, and it's not about Carmen. It's about our children and our great children, and I know the hurt, and I know the horror, and somebody has to do it. Somebody has to get out there and say, enough is enough. God didn't want this for our children. And if we didn't have people for you, like you and Carmen and that, to fight as hard as you do and know the laws inside and outside, there's not very much that I could do. You know, there really isn't very much that I could do. And we just got to awake these people in this world to say, it's time that we stand up. It's time that we protect our children. You know, it's, I don't know how some of these people can sleep. I really don't.
Right.
You know, I really don't know how they can sleep. And it's been a pleasure. I mean, every time I go up on that hill, I don't care who balls I break. You know that. I say what I have to say, and if they don't like it, tough shit.
Right.
And,
You know, somebody has to do it. You people have to do it in a professional way. I don't have to do that. You know, I can go up there and say, listen, you know, enough is enough. And but like I'll say it again, and I'll say it until the day I die. Thank God that we have people like you to fight for us the way you guys fight for us. And that's the truth. And I don't know where we would be today if we didn't have you.
Well, the nonsense has to stop. I mean, with the church, you have purportedly the most moral institution acting the most immorally. I mean, it's mind-boggling how they've done this. And it took me approximately three years in the Gagin cases in the late 90s to go to court every month, every 2 or 3 months, and get more records and more records and more records showing they knew exactly what was going on. They allowed it to happen. I finally got the Cardinal Law's secret files, and it showed that he knew that Gagin was molesting children, and yet he didn't even want parishioners. He kept it quiet. How these people can sleep at night, Eunice, is beyond me, too. I just do not understand how they can act so morally all the time when they're doing the most immoral things to children. I mean, we've had cases, I'm sure Carmen has had cases too, where an abuser was abused by a priest. He goes to speak to the priest supervisor, another priest, and he's abused by that priest. It's endless. It's just absolutely endless.
Yeah, it sure is. It's just
incredible. The thing about the church is, It's not the only institution that's involved here. You've got all kinds of other institutions. I've got a lot of school cases where teachers see other teachers do stuff. Kids go to a teacher and they complain that another teacher is sexually abusing or doing stuff he shouldn't do. And instead of going to the proper supervisor, they go and tell the abusing teacher, hey, kids saying you're doing stuff, watch yourself, watch out for it, you know? And the problem is that the church should be setting the example so that other people will understand what their responsibility is, so that Boy Scout leaders, teachers, doctors, you name it, coaches, that they will do the right thing. But the institution that is supposed to be setting the example for everybody else is setting the wrong kind of example. And, I mean, the thing about the Catholic Church, which makes them the focal point of all this, is that they're a 2,000-year-old institution, and many of the other institutions we deal with have flowed from that Catholic Church. All the Protestant churches came from them. A lot of the things like the Boy Scouts have a religious base and all the rest of it. So, you know, it should be a natural. Look at the example that the church is giving us and do the right thing. But they're not giving the example they should. And the other organizations are acting just like the church. They're putting the welfare of the organization before the welfare of the kids the organization is supposed to serve.
Well, you know, I don't know if you guys heard about this, but in California, the sex offenders were just granted a right by a federal judge to keep their screen names secret because it violates their first free speech. Actually, what he said was the plaintiffs enjoy no less a right to anonymous speech simply because they are unpopular, Judge Dalton Henderson wrote. Voter-approved Proposition 35 requires that registered sex offenders give police a complete list of their screen names, usernames, screen names, email addresses, internet service providers within 24 hours of setting up a new account or a screen name. The violations are punishable up to 3 years in prison. Shortly after its passage in November, two sex offenders sued to block the enforcement of this provision, claiming the requirements are overly broad and impede the right to engage in anonymous online free speech. Henderson found Friday that the plaintiffs are likely to establish that the challenge provisions, when combined with the lack of protections on the information's disclosure and a serious penalty registrants face if they fail to comply with the reporting requirements, create too great a chilling effect to pass the constitutional muster. The government has not demonstrated that the CASE Act's impact on public safety is sufficient to overcome the interest, both to the plaintiffs and to the public, in avoiding infringement of the plaintiff's First Amendment rights. He wrote, in this case, the government has not provided any evidence regarding the extent to which the public safety might be enhanced if the additional registration requirements went into effect. Plaintiff's evidence, as yet not disputed, indicates that only 1% of the arrests for sex crimes against children are for crimes facilitated by technology, and the registered sex offenders are involved in only 4% of those arrests. While the court does not minimize the significance of any single crime, the record at this stage of the proceedings suggests that potential usefulness of the Internet registration information is limited to a very small portion of the universe of sex offenses and online sex offenses.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the short answer is that nobody really knows how many people are affected by stuff like this. They're just talking about arrest statistics, and the arrest statistics are a function of people who will come forward, and we know that the number of people who come forward versus the number of people who are abused are wildly out of proportion. The U.S. Center for Disease Control has a statistic that they've extrapolated from the number of people that have come forward and based on the studies about the numbers of, you know, how abuse occurs and the number of likely victims, et cetera. Their estimate is that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men will be abused during their lifetime. Now, if you take that and you bring it out into population figures, you're talking on average about 1/5 of the population of the United States will be at some point in their lives sexually abused, which would make that the biggest mental health problem in the United States. If you start talking numbers like that, then what you have to start saying is we know we're not getting people coming forward or prosecuting people anywhere near those numbers. Why is that? And then you go into the reasons why people don't talk about it. All the people who are sexually abused in a family situation and who, until they become adults and leave the family, think that's the way families are normally. It's part of growing up. So all is a tremendous amount of that family abuse. All the other people who are so ashamed that they can't ever tell anybody about it. So, you know, I understand what the judge is saying. He's saying based on the statistics we've got, we can't justify it constitutionally. Okay, I hear that. But, I mean, that's why you have to keep these guys in the criminal system or get information, public information on them somewhere, so that people can at least protect themselves to the extent of knowing who the people are who've been accused previously of doing this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mitch told you a story about how long these guys do it. I had one priest who abused his first kid when he was 25 years old, and the last person he abused was when he was 86 years old. So what's
wow.
that, 61 years of doing the same thing? They keep doing it if they have the opportunity to do it. You know, there's a lot of mythology about sexual abuse. The idea that it has to do solely with sex and sex drives. In fact, it has an awful lot more to do with the issue of power and control.
Control, right.
Yeah, and for that reason, it's not something people say, well, you know, you get older, your sex drive wanes, therefore you're less likely to do this. That's absurd. These guys keep doing it not because their sex drive is you know, they're taking Viagra or whatever. They're doing it because the desire to have this power is something that stays with them for their entire lives.
And they really
take
believe
every opportunity that comes their way where they can do this without getting caught, or they think they won't get caught, they will take that opportunity. And that's why the 86-year-old man, he got caught, finally. When he was 85, he got caught. And he was prosecuted. He died before the prosecution could take place, before he could actually go to trial. But while he was out on bail, he abused someone again when he was 86 while he was awaiting trial. So, you know, these are people we have to find a way to track and control, because if we don't, they will keep abusing our kids.
Mm-hmm. And they also really believe that the child come on to them in a lot of cases. You know, it was the child.
You talk to the people who treat sexual abusers. There's a special organization of physicians who therapists who treat people who are known to be sex offenders. And they will tell you how difficult it is to treat these people because they do not understand that they are doing anything wrong. They don't need treatment because they haven't done anything for which they should be treated. The only way in which they are able successfully to treat somebody who is a sex abuser is if that person has been prosecuted, is on probation, and they can go to the probation officer and say he's not cooperating in his treatment, and the probation officer can surrender him and send him back to jail. Well, that gives the treater an effective tool to say, look, you may not think you need this treatment, but if you don't cooperate in treatment with me, that's what I'm going to do, and you're going to go back to jail. They say that's the only way in which they get cooperation from these guys. They don't think they've done anything wrong. They think they've conferred a benefit on their victim, or they think they've provided the victim with a normal rite of passage that all kids should have. These are people whose mindset is different from everybody else's. And, you know, people come in to see me and they want two things. They want to know what they can do to stop the person from hurting anyone else. And the second thing, they'd like to have the person apologize to them. And I say, you know, forget about number two, because even if he apologizes to you, it's not going to be because he means it, because he doesn't understand he did anything wrong.
Wow.
And that raises the issue of where were the supervisors? Why aren't they supervising properly? Because if they know and people know that these perverts, these pedophiles are out of touch, what's the excuse for the supervisors? What's the excuse for the cardinal laws of the world? I mean, are they out of touch too? Are they not in touch with reality? I mean, it's
well,
just...
Well, if they're out of touch, why are they left in that position?
Because they're making money. They don't care. They care about the institutional wealth. They don't care about the health and safety and welfare of children. They don't care about that. You know, we even have mandated reporting laws that we have to bulk up on. And for 4 years, I fought in the Massachusetts legislature to amend mandated reporting laws in the early 2000s. And about 2004, it was finally passed, but they watered down the bill. So that I fought for it to include priests and other people in charge of the welfare and safety of children. I included that in the bill, but I wanted a criminal sentence in there if people didn't comply with mandated reporting laws. But they watered it down, and at the last minute they inserted a $1,000 fine instead of the penalty of a criminal sanction. Are criminal, or the ability to be charged criminally. And so... you know, we need to hold these supervisors responsible. And one way to do it is to bulk up on not only the direct criminal laws, but the mandated reporting laws. There has to be penalties in there so that people who don't report are responsible for supervising individuals in the care and custody of children have to report, or else they can be facing criminal charges. We really have to get the laws in place to protect children across the board. You know, as Carmen was saying, these pedophiles are out of touch with reality. Well, if they're out of touch with reality, what's the excuse for the supervisors? I mean, it has to end somewhere. Somebody has to be held responsible.
Well, hopefully this is what we can try to do is hold them responsible. That's a battle and a half too, you know. People don't realize that we're fighting against big institutions. I mean, let's face it, you know. all we can do is make a dent in it. But if I can make a dent, you can make a dent, and everybody down the road can make a dent. We can really put a big hole in it, you know.
Well, Eunice, they may be big institutions, but we have decided. We're going to keep working with you. We're going to follow your lead. We're going to keep doing this. They can be as big as they want. They're not going to get away with this if we can help it.
No, not if I can help it. You know,
we appreciate all support that we get for this.
Definitely.
Well, like I said, you guys send me your stuff. I'll post it for you.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much for having us on. I certainly appreciate it. And
you're welcome
back
anytime.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's great.
Maybe someday we'll be able to call you back and tell you we've had some success here.
Please.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I'll talk to you guys. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure
thank
they
you.
Do, too.
Right.
Have a great evening.
Great.
Good night, Roseanne.
Bye.
Take care, Carmen. Mitchell.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.
Good
night.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Bye.
Hey, Phil, did my girl Kelly hang up? Or is she still, you know, floating around somewhere?
Hung up.
She hung up. Damn, she just sent me a text, too, saying that she is really enjoying this show. She said it was a reality check for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she learned a little something more tonight than she knew yesterday. So, you know, all's good. All it takes is one more person to know about this subject and to be able to verbally get across to somebody else who'll get across to somebody else. And, you know, with luck, Eunice and her friends will get this done along with everybody else trying to help a little bit.
I'll tell you, those guys are amazing. They really are.
I've talked to Hermes about those guys, yeah.
Pardon?
I said I've talked to Hermes about those guys.
Yeah, they're straight shooters. They really are, and they really do care. That's, you know, like I said, you don't find too many people like that, and a lot of them out there to just make money. But I, you know, these guys have put a lot of their time and money and effort into this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I try to get some jokes in there, but they weren't picking up on them. Yes.
You might see my picture.
Huh?
I said, that's why I made the comment that you might see my picture hanging there.
Yeah. You know, it's
don't
it's
fuck
amazing.
With that
I'm
guy.
Glad they come on. Huh?
It'll say underneath my picture, don't fuck with this guy. He's a pain in the ass.
Because he's got
that's
big guns.
That's what they say up at the state house with me. Don't fuck with her. You know.
Hey, Eunice, you know what? Maybe when it's all said and done, there'll be a nice picture hanging up of you in the state house. Woman who knows how to get the job done. You know?
Well, like I said before, and I'll say it again, it's not about me or Carmen or any of them. It's about our children.
Right.
And that's the compassion that I have for it. And,
you know something, Eunice, I'm going to tell you, and I will say this from now probably until the day I grow old, I cannot believe that you have been advocating for this for 32 years and people just can't open up their eyes and do what's right because it all boils down to money, you know, and that's what's just such bullshit about all of it. You know, you got people who are hurting and people who are learning to cope with things that have happened and, you know, they just, it's kind of like a big smack in their face that their own state it doesn't care. They just want to sweep it under the rug, and it burns in me. It really does.
Well, that's why it's so important that we do the best we can do, you know. And Carmen said it today when, you know, he met with Brownsburg and that, and Brownsburg wasn't a very favorable person because he didn't understand it like a lot of people didn't understand it. Because a lot of people don't know what pedophilia is. You know, it's never touched them. And Brownsberger is one of our biggest fighters now. You know? He's trying to get a special committee together. He wants to get this done and over with. And he promised me I talked to him last Saturday. And he says, Eunice, if it's the last thing I do, he says, we're going to do something, get this done, you know? But if you touch one person, if tonight having Carmen and Mitchell on there, if we touched one person to say, okay, I'm going to stop fighting for this. I'm going to get in touch with my congressman. I'm going to get in touch with my senator or my representative, you know. Then we've done something. It's one more person to get on the bandwagon.
Right.
Excuse me. I wish I could get rid of this cough.
You still have that cough. It doesn't sound as bad as what it did last week, Eunice.
No, like I know. I feel a little bit better, but, you know. Is Sandy still on?
No.
Oh, okay.
Up with now.
But, so what did you think of the guys, girls, guys?
They're awesome. You know?
Yeah, very informative.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I learned more tonight than viewing the news and, of course, you know, hearsay from other different people over the last several years with all of this stuff.
You won't
hear
it on the news because they won't touch it.
Right.
No,
tonight,
they won't.
Tonight it kind of summed it up in a nutshell for me real good, like a nice tight package, you know?
Yeah,
so
that's why you have to. And I'm so happy that they agreed to come on. See, they don't want people to think that the lawyers are running it, you know, because they're really not. It's people like us to keep them going, you know. And I says, Carmen, you people can answer questions that I can't answer.
Yep.
And it didn't take them two seconds to say, we'll be on. Well, come on, you know.
They did a fantastic job, too, you know. I mean, geez, I'm still, I got 50 million things rolling around in my brain after listening to all that, and I'm still like, wow, totally blown out a little bit.
And that's why Mitchell Garabedian is one of the biggest. I mean, he has cases, you know, for these lawyers to have cases in different states, different countries, they have to go down there and pass their law, you know, their bar exams in each state, in each country. So, I mean, you can imagine the monies that they put out to do this. So it's amazing. It's totally amazing.
Wow. I feel bad. I feel bad for the kids in this country, but I feel even more bad for, like they were talking about, children overseas, because a lot of the overseas community and stuff, they don't have the things in place like we do, you know.
Right.
It's a totally different environment, and children are just kind of shuffled.
It's called corruption.
Yeah,
right.
I'm trying to be nice about it, Phil, because this is a sensitive subject, so I'm trying to be nice.
Every time I go to court, I think it's the legalized extortion.
Yeah, you know, but I just, it's bigger than the state of Massachusetts, and that is so obvious right now with everything we talked about. You know, it's got to go beyond Massachusetts. It's got to.
Well, of course
it
does. It's got to go
right
national. We got to get our government into this.
Yep.
You know, it's
exactly.
That opened that up to you, because the month of December we had 1.5 million plus people look at the blog. Whatever you guys want to do. Eunice, get somebody to sit down with pen and paper, write it out, send it to me, and I'll post it.
All right. Know what I'm going to do is I'm going to have
I can post all the links you send me, but that's not going to do nothing without a story.
Yeah, well, you know, Mitchell and Carmen are the ones to really write up that story and to bring it forth. You know, once we can get this done, Phil, you don't know how far it can spread, you know? Like it says, it's like, you know, a snowball. You know, you get that little ball running, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But people can't be afraid to ask questions and be afraid not to talk about this, you know? Because the only time they're ever going to talk about it is if it happens to them in their family.
Yeah, it's kind of like we have I'm sure it's more than just this area, but a couple of people, you know, will say,
they've gotten killed at a certain intersection that should, let's say, have four stop signs instead of two. And the old cliche is, well, when it happens to somebody in Congress or the Senate or the state legislator or the mayor's office, when it's one of their kids, cousins, nephews, whatever, then there'll be more stop signs put up. And that's exactly, you know, with what you're saying.
People are afraid to fight any kind of organization.
Yep.
And of course, when they keep going back to the Catholic Church, and Carmen said it so right, that every other church came out of the Catholic Church. These people broke off. The Protestants started their own church and so forth, you know. this has been going on for centuries, and it was okay.
Why I still think I still think men that molested women became Mormons.
Really? You know, the one question that's been asked of me, Phil, when I do these little speaking engagements is, well, don't you think if the priest gets married that there won't be no pedophilia? Nah, that has nothing to do with it. What makes you? They don't want women.
No. And you know something? I mean, most statistics for people that are molested, let's say outside of the church, it's somebody, you know,
in
close
the family.
That possibly has a wife or a husband and kids and is just folding into, you know, everything coming across as the normal functioning adult
family.
In society. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, guys, it's 11 o'clock. Thank you, Phil, for having us on.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. And when you have time, you know something, just call my phone and leave me that information. Then I can copy it down.
Okay.
Hey, you. What, hon?
I'm looking at the TV right now, and it says winter advisory in the morning, so put on your snowshoes.
I'm down here in Florida.
Oh, I thought you were up here in Mass. So you're missing it then.
It's 31 degrees out.
Huh?
I said I'll send you a snowball.
In California, 9 miles from the ocean, it's 31 degrees right now.
You
wow.
deserve
wow.
it, Bill. You deserve all that cold. It was sent
yes.
just for you.
So when you have time, Phil, if you just want to put it on my phone.
I will.
I won't answer it, and then I can copy it down and call Roseanne and Carmen tomorrow and give them the information, and he can send you a lot of stuff.
Okay, I will.
All right.
I'll send in the morning. And then,
I hope we get...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I hope we get a good response, you know, from them tonight. I think they did a great job, so.
Yeah. I'll let you know the numbers.
All right, and I'll talk to you guys Thursday. Have a good night.
Take
care.
We'll talk to you later.
All right, I'm going to let Charlie
drop
Baker.
Drop the phone and cough. You going to
let Charlie up? Baker take us out with a little ride.
All right.
You guys.
Good night, guys.
All right, we'll see you guys.
Bye.
All right, good night, everybody.